Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are. This week, new unemployment claims are up, but it's seen as a blip. The number of those unemployed more than a month is down. Consumer sales are up. Happy days here again? Not for Michael Steele. A North Carolina Republican chairman is asking for Steele's resignation. Why should he have a problem? Buying booze and expensing them as office supplies? Paying for donors to go to a club where there's simulated sex acts? Come on, guys, chill. Since last we met, actor John Forsythe has died. Some of us remember him from Dynasty or Charlie's Angels, but I heard no news report that mentioned that he starred in Bachelor Father back in the late 50s or early 60s. Is it possible they're ignoring that because he might have been the first protagonist on television who was supposed to be gay? I'm just saying. Governor McDonald of Virginia has issued a non-apology apology with regard to his announcement of Confederate History Week. We'll explain. In a brilliant diplomatic move, Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, cancels his trip to a nuclear summit to which he was invited by President Obama. Yep, that'll improve the relationship. The British election is announced, and they're going to have televised debates for the first time. And if you want to be a political leader in the United States, you should think about leaving the country in April. We'll explain that too. German automaker Daimler was in the news last week in reference to paying fines for paying bribes. This week, they announced they'll be making cars for the United States market with their former partner Chrysler. My question, if they're made of flexible materials like aluminum and plastic, will they call it the Mercedes Bend? Okay. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. We're going to have all of that, news of the weird, our return guest, Larry Hancock, an author who's written books on the 60s political assassinations, and he'll be talking to us tonight about the murder of Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles. But first, if you are thinking of making an investment in real estate and are afraid to do so because of the way the market has been, that's understandable. But let me tell you about a good one you can make. Mobile home investment. And if you'd like a book on it, we happen to be able to tell you about that too because I wrote it. You can go to the website mobilemillionaire, as if that were one word, .blogspot.com. It deals with how to get into mobile home investment, for renting them out, for financing them, and how to do it with little or no money. Want to talk about these headlines and but before I do that, I wanted to give you our phone number. It is 347-994-3796. And if you'd like to join us before our guest, of course, feel free. If you'd like to join us after the guest, that's fine, too. Actually, we have a caller calling in from New Jersey, apparently, and let's see if we can bring him in. Are you there, caller? There we go. Are you there? Hello, New Jersey, are you there? Okay, there's someone who is supposed to be there, or they apparently are on the switchboard, but they're not talking to us. So I want to give it another shot before I click it off. Are you there? 1, 2, 3. Okay, if you can hear me, since we can't hear you, please give us a call back. And that number again, everybody, is 347-994-3796. And apparently that was the phantom caller. He must have heard us talk and decided he didn't want to join us after he called in. Anyway, let's talk about those headlines. You've heard all the stories about Michael Steele, so we needn't go into that. The new unemployment claims for this week are up, but a couple of things. Those who have been unemployed more than a month, that's a number they also follow, that's down. What that means is that people who are out of work are finding jobs faster. The unemployment rate is still high. It's still hovering around 10%. But the fact is that in addition to the unemployed more than a month number being down, which is a good thing if you're looking for a job, the other factor is that temporary workers have been increased enormously over the last several months. And virtually every economist says the recession is over, and definitionally that's certainly true. Obviously, unemployment continues to be a stubborn problem. Governor McDonald, he won election last November as the new governor of Virginia on the same day that Governor Christie, one in New Jersey, both Republicans. And last week, earlier this week, rather, Governor McDonnell issued a declaration that it was going to be Confederate History Week, and it was going to be observed in the state, the Commonwealth of Virginia. He didn't mention slavery at all when discussing the Confederacy, and naturally there was a backlash. I believe it was today, in fact it was today, he said, among other things, the following. He said, "I apologize to any fellow Virginian who was offended." And I mentioned at the top, this is a non-apology apology. These happen all the time with politicians, sports figures, people who use bigoted words, and they, in order to save face, in other words, make an insincere apology, they say, "I apologize to anyone who was offended." It's a way of saying, you shouldn't have been offended, but if you were, I apologize to you because I'm being big. Well, you weren't being big, Governor. You were being small. A big person would have said, "I apologize to all of my fellow Virginians and anyone else I offended. I was wrong. I messed up. I am sorry." That's how you make an apology. You can call it an apology, but if you're not saying something like that, it doesn't have to be those exact words, obviously, unless I rule the world. But if you're making an apology like the one I just mentioned, that's an apology. "I'm sorry, I messed up, I'll try to do better," whatever. But not, "I apologize to anyone who was offended." That's actually almost as insulting as forgetting to mention slavery at all. There has been a real rift in the relationship between Israel and the United States for the for some basic political reasons. Here's what's going on. In Israel, there are essentially two parties. There are a great many more, but there are essentially two large parties. There is the Likud party, which is a rather more conservative party, and there is the Labor party, which is, by definition, something of a more liberal party. The Labor party's antecedents are actually socialist, and I say socialist not in a negative way in this context, but the current leader of Israel is a representative of the Likud bloc, or Likud party, and that's Prime Minister Netanyahu. And the more conservative people in Israel, the more conservative parties in Israel, believe that there should be more and more settlements of Jews in Israel in areas that that Arabs think are theirs, the Palestinians think are theirs. So that's creating a conflict. And the President of the United States, President Obama, at the risk of offending those of you who already knew that Barack Obama is President of the United States, wants the settlements to not go forward because, to the extent they do, it makes it harder and harder to bring the Israelis and the Palestinians together for peace talks in an effort to try to resolve the differences that have been there for 60 years and more. So the more settlements that are put in, the more residential establishments for Jews in Israel, or more correctly, or not correctly, but more at least arguably, in the occupied territories, then the more and more difficult it is to bring that to peace. So there has been a rift. The president has indicated that he would prefer that these settlements not occur. And the thing that happened most recently is the vice president was in Israel when an announcement was made that more settlements were going to be established, which was seen as something of an insult, although presumably it was done accidentally in terms of the timing. But that's the reason. And now, as we mentioned earlier, the prime minister, who had previously agreed to attend this summit with regard to nuclear proliferation, has decided he's not going to go. He didn't give the reason that he didn't want to come in and be criticized by the president. But it's reasonable suspicion that that's something of what's going on. By the way, the Labor Party in Israel, which did not win the last election, is generally in favor of limiting or reducing the settlements of Jews in the territories that the Palestinians claim. And these last settlements are going into East Jerusalem. The Palestinians would like Jerusalem to be their capital. The Israelis have Jerusalem as their capital now. And some people who are interested in a two-state solution have said that Jerusalem should be the equal and undivided capital of both nation-states, but clearly the more residences that are put in there, more settlements, the more difficult that becomes. Anyway, that's the situation there. The British election is going to occur on May 6th. The British government and the Israeli government and many others around the world are parliamentary systems. In addition to the fact that means they have a parliament, as contrasted with the Congress, what that means is that the prime minister of the country is essentially chosen in a parliamentary process, not the way we choose a president, where people vote for the president, the presidential candidate of their choice. As a rule, there are certain exceptions, but as a rule in parliamentary systems, what happens is that people vote for the local candidate of their choice to represent them in the usually the lower house of the parliament, equivalent to our House of Representatives. In Britain, that's the House of Commons. What happens then is that that house votes for who becomes prime minister. The prime minister is always a member of the parliament, but essentially doesn't serve in that seat while serving as prime minister. The effect of that is that the majority party, or more correctly, the party that gets the greatest number of votes in the parliamentary election, generally chooses the prime minister. Now, there are lots of wrinkles on that in terms of minority parties and making deals to form coalitions and so forth, but that's the essence of it. We mentioned earlier, as by way of an example, that the Likud and the Labour parties in Israel were the primary parties. Well, in Britain, that is, again, a Labour Party and the Conservatives. The Labour Party is currently in possession of number 10 Downing Street, where the Prime Minister lives, equivalent to our White House in rough terms. And the Prime Minister is Gordon Brown. He is going to be running, of course. He is the leader of the Labour Party, and he has announced the elections will take place. In a parliamentary system, elections must be held usually within a specified period of time, but anywhere within there, the prime minister can call an election, and that's what's occurred. So in this particular election round, unlike their experience previously, they're actually going to have televised debates between the candidates for prime minister. They're taking a page out of the book of the United States and Canada. Canada typically has done that as well. So that's what's happening there. So that should be interesting. Now, the question is, what effect does the British election have on us? The answer, generally speaking, is none. The reality is that Britain, being under the United States' military protection, not to say that they don't also have a military force, but they're under our nuclear umbrella. And there will always be that, or at least for in the foreseeable future, a what is called a special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States. And that essentially is not going to change. The only things that may change is that there is a possibility that if the Conservatives win, although they generally favor the activity in Afghanistan, they may withdraw some British troops. But the fact is that there aren't a lot of British troops there compared to Americans anyway, so it probably won't make a major difference. But that's essentially what's going on there, and like most foreign stories, this one is being very poorly covered by the United States press, in my view. We often talk on this show about books we like, and we'll mention that in a moment, but I want to invite you, if there's a book you're reading or have just read that you'd like to recommend to people, to call in. The number here is 347-994-3796. In about 10 minutes or so, we'll be joined by Larry Hancock to talk about Robert Kennedy and his murder. The book we're reading at the moment is called Team of Rivals. This was a bestseller, and was generally in the press quite some time ago when it first came out. I'm just getting around to it. It is a book which details the election of Abraham Lincoln and how he brought his rivals for that nomination within the Republican Party into his cabinet. And it's fascinating to watch how leadership works when you're reading this book. The author is Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's written a number of books about presidents and the histories of them, including, actually, a book about Lyndon Johnson, whom she knew. And it's a book that I recommend to you. I'm only about 40 or 50 pages in, but it is outstanding, very well written, besides interesting. It's very well written, and I would recommend it to you. Want to talk about News of the Weird, and we'll do that in just a moment. But first, I also want to tell you that if you have a business and have a website and you're not blogging, you're missing the best thing you can do to drive eyeballs to your website and to chase dollars to your bottom line. You can do it yourself for free, or you can have a professional writer do your blogging for you for under $100 a month. Go to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and read all about it. Again, that's jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. Every week we try to present News of the Weird that we get from newsoftheweird.com. It's a great website, and they talk about strange things in the news, and here are a couple of them. And, it looks like we have time to deliver them both. So here's the first one. Michael Kelly, last week, got a hysterical phone call from his mother saying that his 9-year-old son was missing. As could be imagined, Michael panicked. He then made a couple of bad choices on his way to mom's house. Driving at speeds up to 120 miles an hour, he ran a red light, and he refused to stop for police. Finally, he arrived at his mother's house. He was arrested on several charges, as you can imagine. What about his son? He's fine. Michael's mom says it was just an April Fool's joke. Nice going, Mom. The best April Fool's joke that was ever played on me was by my lovely bride when we were in a situation where we were in no position to get a dog. We now have one who is, in fact, the producer of this show, Autumn Bushman, and her assistant in producing the show, Alicia, my wife. I was at work. As I said, we had decided we weren't going to get a dog. We were in no position to do it. It was a bad idea, blah, blah, blah. And that's from the school of blah, 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 as you may know. And she called me at work, and we were talking about other things. She says, listen, I've got a little problem. And I said, what is it? And she says, well, I opened the door, and a dog came in. He's a stray, he's beautiful, and we need to keep him. And as might be imagined, my hairline went back about 3/4 inch, and it felt very, very good in that one sense when she said, April Fool. So that was the... you probably have a better one, and if you want to share it, of course you can. Here's the other story. A rather large oops situation took place at the Cape Fear Valley Medical Center. This actually took place a little over a year ago. A cesarean section was performed on a patient after several days of attempting to induce labor. The problem? She wasn't pregnant. Several days in the hospital, multiple attempts to induce labor, an epidural, and the beginning of a C-section, and no baby. Upon seeing a non-pregnant uterus, they closed her up. She was suffering from what's called, if I'm going to pronounce this right, pseudocyesis, and I'm getting a positive response, or false pregnancy. This can be caused by either psychological or hormonal problems. I'm only laughing because I mentioned the dog, and I know somebody whose dog went through this. But anyway, you'd think it would be a simple process to discover the fact that there was no baby by either a physical exam or ultrasound. And since it took such an invasive procedure to come to the proper conclusion, the state medical board launched an investigation. As said, this occurred at the end of 2008. A year later, at the end of 2009, just fairly recently, the medical board of the state took action. They fired off letters of concern to the doctors involved. That's the end of the story. They're not going to be disciplined. There's going to be no punishment, no licensure problems. They got a letter. Now, if any of you want to avoid that hospital, Cape Fear Valley Medical Center, I looked it up. It's in North Carolina. So don't get sick there. Or if you do, be glad that there's a health plan that's essentially in place now. I'd like to talk for a moment about juvenile humor. Okay, I mentioned juvenile humor not from the standpoint of children, but of humor that's juvenile. I have a, how can I put this? A number of people who know me well can't believe that I like things like Beavis and Butthead or South Park or Family Guy, but I do. I like those all a lot. Beavis and Butthead always amuse the heck out of me. Had I really been an adherent, I would have used a different word. But it always amused me. And I want to present a challenge to you if you wish to take it. And if you do, you can call in next week with it. And we will take the calls. And keep in mind, I have my finger on the cancel switch. We're on a slight delay. But the challenge to you is to... I invented one today, which I won't share until next week, if then. But I want you to come up with a name that one could give to the hostess in a restaurant when one has to wait for a table, so that when the announcement is made, the name is funny. Okay? Now, as not that this is my example, but just as an example, we all heard the joke when we were children about someone who put in their name in a classroom under the name Michael Hunt, and great amusement when the teacher calls that name. And its shortened version, I'll let you use your imagination. So in that context, if you have a name that would be funny to say, either with that bent or some other, please, of course, share it with us, and we'll share ours with you. I will give one other example, not because it was smutty, and that's why I'm telling it now. The one I invented today is more in the smutty area, as is Michael Hunt. But the other one is from a long time ago, or built up over a long time, when someone is writing down the name for you and they ask you your name. I occasionally use the name Shasta Hostakakovich, and watch what happens when they try to write it. And if they should ask me the first name, because they figure it'll be easier, I give them Estanislao. Now, Estanislao is an actual, perfectly good Hispanic first name. But as you can imagine, there aren't too many people who walk around with the name Estanislao Shasta Hostakakovich. So it's always fun when they try to call your name. Usually they catch on, start laughing, and you have to give them the real name. But if you're better at keeping a straight face than I am, then more power to you, and that'll work. We expect to hear from Larry Hancock momentarily. I just wanted to mention briefly another item of international news. The country of Greece, not the movie, not the play, but the country, has been experiencing some serious financial difficulty for a variety of reasons. But one of the ways you tell the viability of a country's economy is by the interest rate they have to pay on their bonds. This can get really arcane, but in brief, when the issuance of a bond, of a government bond, a treasury bond or a treasury note, it reflects that the government is borrowing money. So in the simplest example, if you go buy a United States savings bond, Series E or Series H, and you spend, I don't even remember what it costs, but I believe you pay $25 now, and in 7 years or 5 years or whatever, you get 50 back. Well, that's a bond, and the amount that you pay at the beginning and that you receive later is based on an assumed interest rate, and that interest rate that's paid is based on the general belief of the marketplace as to how worthy your credit is. In as a country, and corporations issue bonds doing the same thing. And generally speaking, right now, interest rates are relatively low, particularly on United States Treasury bonds, U.S. government bonds, because people know that the government is good for it. We may be spending a lot of money, we may be in deficit, and in debt. But China, for example, knows that we're going to continue paying our debt regardless of how things tough get. So they are willing to lend us money. That's basically it. But Greece is having a problem now in that the last reported rate of interest they've had to pay is, if I remember what I read correctly, 7.5%. For a government bond, that's enormous. That's more than you would pay if you went to go buy a house. And if your credit is better than that of a country, nothing against you, but that country is in trouble. So that's what's occurring. And the fact is, no one is coming up with a plan on how to overcome that problem. So that's what's going on. So in terms of what's going on with Greece, you can expect that to be in the news more and more. Once it's a disaster, it'll hit the news even more. I believe that we have Larry Hancock joining us. Larry, are you there?
It is me.
Oh, good, good, good. Hi. Well, let me introduce you again. Larry Hancock is the author of, is it two books now?
One book in print and one coming out in January.
Okay. And the book that's in print has to do with the assassination and cover-up regarding John F. Kennedy. And he'll talk about his new book in a couple of minutes. And he has been on the show before, as you know if you've been listening. And the times before, we've been discussing the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. Tonight we're going to be talking about Bobby Kennedy. But Larry's book is available on Amazon and at LarryHancock.com. And tell me what I've left out, Larry.
No, that's, I think actually it's Larry-Hancock.com.
I beg your pardon. That's right, Larry-Hancock.com. And what is the name of the book that they can find on Amazon?
That is Someone Would Have Talked.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, that's right, and then I realized I would have sounded like an idiot, like I had given you a test that you passed. And the new book is, you have a title for it, I assume, since it's coming out so soon.
It's Seeking Armageddon.
And the subject of Seeking Armageddon is?
Will be the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Right, okay. So, which is what we talked about last time you were on, and involves James Earl Ray and all of his travels and so forth, correct?
Indeed.
Okay. Well, first off, welcome back. It's great to have you back with us. And tonight we're going to talk about the Robert Kennedy assassination. But before we do that, is there anything you wanted to add in terms of your books or your website or anything like that?
No, I think that covers it. The one thing I would add that there are two great resources for people that want to look into this on the web, and one of them is a website, www.maryferrell.com.
That's M-A-R-Y.
F-E-R-R-E-L-L.
Okay, .com.
And that might be useful. It does have, I've done a almost book-length series of essays on RFK and his assassination conspiracy, and it's on that website. And so if anybody gets interested in the discussion tonight, that would be a good place to go into way more depth than we'll have time.
Okay, yes, of course. And additionally, of course, at some point in time, you will probably make that into a third book.
There were way too many assassinations in the 60s. There's just not enough time.
So many murders, so time. Okay. Well, first, before we get into the discussion of the conspiracy, I wanted to, as I had, briefed you on, previously, I guess in a previous conversation or email correspondence, I have some very loose connection with the Bobby Kennedy situation. As a kid, I volunteered in the campaign in Southern California. And, of course, as a kid, the work that I did was all of the, you know, grunt stuff that everybody does, sending mail, calling people, trying to get them to the polls and so forth. And on June 4th, as the afternoon waned and the election was taking place, I was invited to go to the ambassador. And more specifically, I was invited to go in somebody's car. I was too young to drive. So In those days, as you may remember, and those of us who are old enough will remember, most cars were bigger than they are now.
Much.
Yeah, but the number of passengers, I guess what I'm saying is you could actually fit people in the back seat. It wasn't that big a deal. But I asked how many people were already going in the car. There were six. I was going to be the seventh, and it occurred to me that that might create some discomfort. So I opted out of that trip and obviously was not in the Ambassador on the night of. The night of the assassination was also the night of the California primary, during which Robert Kennedy beat Gene McCarthy and Hubert Humphrey, among others. And it was at night, it was very late that night, that after he gave his speech to the assembled celebrants, that he was killed. Go ahead and pick up the story in terms of what occurred, and then we can talk about the possibilities or the reality of conspiracy.
Sure. I wish you had been there, because if you had been in the right spot, we could have certainly used another witness.
Yeah.
But that's a good lead-in, because it's very important. This is one of those things where it's very important to really get a grasp for the assassination, to understand the physical layout of the hotel,
mm-hmm.
and where it happened. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did do in that series of articles that I mentioned on the Mary Farrell website is I had some help, and we did a series of real in-depth illustrations of the hotel and diagrams of the ballroom and the pantry, because the senator was actually shot in a small pantry, a service hall. If any of the listeners are familiar with hotel rooms or hotels, there's a whole world behind the ballrooms and the meeting rooms of service hallways and kitchens and serving pantries. And the reason it occurred in the pantry is because the Senator Kennedy had been really going through lots of crowds during that that campaign, and was really kind of beat and tired and just needed to collect himself. And he asked if he could, he was told that they were going to go out and essentially wade through the huge crowds on the escalators and in the front of the ballroom and try to fight their way through the ballroom. And he asked if there was any way to get there without doing that. And so they took him mm-hmm. down a service elevator through the kitchen, through a serving hallway, and on to the stage from the rear of the ballroom, and everybody was out in the front, the cameras were out front, and it was kind of anticipated that he would leave through the crowd in front, but actually...
Way. Oh, okay.
It was so dense that he elected to go back and exit through the pantry the way he had come, and mm-hmm. that was where the attack occurred.
Okay. Now, when he was in this, you're calling it a pantry, I didn't see it except on television, but I would have referred to it as a corridor. That is, it was a long, unless, and you're welcome to correct me, but it was like a long, narrow aisle down which they were walking. Is that correct?
Well, basically the hallway started behind the stage, and then as you got mm-hmm. Down that hallway, you went through a set of double doors and into an area which still looked like a hallway, except it had tables and tray racks, and was kind of it was right outside the kitchen, so it was a staging area for the food that would be served in the ballrooms, and that's why it's thought of as a pantry, because actually Sirhan was more or less standing behind a large set of serving trays and racks and somewhat shielded, and came out behind that to fire his pistol at RFK.
Okay. Now, so give us the scenario. First off, do we know, let's take this back to the JFK assassination. In that circumstance, there has always been controversy about the number of bullets, the number of shooters, the location of shooters, the entry and exit wounds, and so forth. Do we have anything similar to that in the RFK killing?
100% similar, unfortunately. And
talk
you
about
would...
it.
You would think not, because actually one of the first things that you heard from the Los Angeles police was, well, we're going to make sure that this doesn't leave all of the loose ends and open questions that they mm-hmm. had in Dallas, and as it ended
right.
up, there are probably more. There's a great deal of controversy. Clearly there were more shots fired than were in Sirhan's pistol, and when I say clearly... There are actually not in the crime scene photos, but in the photographer's photos, news photos that are available of the pantry, there are literally more bullet marks and more holes than there should be if you followed the official story of what Sir Ann shot. And I think one case is particularly egregious, and that is that there were bullets reported being fired into the door panel. As I said, the senator had gone through a door, and people observed holes in the wood in the divider panel. Well, the official story is that those were just dings from carts going through or just dents or whatever. Well, later a researcher actually was creative enough to do a little exploration, and he went to the hotel repair staff and actually found a hotel carpenter who testified to him that the police had called him to take the paneling off that door, which he did so that they could dig out two bullets from the door frame.
Right.
And
yeah,
right,
so there are obviously bullets there.
Yeah, so right there, those two bullets extend the count beyond what was in Sirhan's gun. So more bullets, more holes than there should have been. The Sirhan, there's a lot of argument as to how close he got. Virtually no one thought that he got within more than 2 or 3 feet from RFK, yet even the coroner's report shows that the fatal shot was fired from within 1 to 2 inches of the senator's head. And that
is that because there were powder burns?
That's because there were powder burns, yes.
Okay.
And there's no good explanation.
Go ahead. Well, what I was going to say is it true that the powder burns indicate very close range?
Yes. And the forensic people, yes, that's why the autopsy report and the autopsy doctor were totally positive about how close it was fired. And actually, the autopsy doctor is on record as having said that right before the trial, he was approached by staff from the DA's office and asked to change his story and move it back several inches so that it would at least be in a gray area, because the way it is now is it's not gray at all. Sirhan was not that close.
Okay. So what it boils down to is, in spite of what we were told, Sirhan could not have fired the fatal shot.
It certainly doesn't seem that way. And nobody... To come up with a scenario where it works that way, you literally have to disregard all of the witnesses.
Okay. And did any of the witnesses name somebody else or point to somebody else as a shooter, either at the time of the event or afterwards?
There are a couple of news reports that where witnesses are interviewed where they talk about having seen other individuals with pistols. Talks about seeing an individual leaving the pantry area with what he thinks is a pistol hidden inside a rolled-up newspaper. One of them, there were, because it was very crowded and very, you know, it's not a good environment, those aren't, you know, they're not as solid as you would like to be, but certainly those reports existed. And I think what's worse is, we now have copies of tapes and other documents about the LAPD interviews of those witnesses. And the one fellow who was very specific about seeing someone else fire a gun, in the interview, they forgot to turn off their tape recorders. And you hear the two officers talking to each other basically saying, well, we're going to have to get him back here, and we're going to have to keep working with him until he stops saying that.
No kidding.
And
go ahead.
So that is common. There are several examples of that, and actually some far worse examples in the handling of one of the primary witnesses who reported seeing conspirators leave the building.
Talk about who that witness is and what he or she reported.
Her name was Sandra Serrano. And she was a RFK campaign worker. That sounds familiar. And she made a long story short. She had been watching, and everybody was waiting for the senator to come down. Nobody knew exactly when he was going to come, and it was really packed in the main ballroom. And so she'd been watching from a staff room downstairs, and it was pretty packed. So she decided to go out, and she was actually sitting outside on a fire escape outside the rear entrances to the rooms. And her story is that shortly before, she wasn't exact time, but shortly before the senator was finished with his speaking, these three people came up the stairway and went past her and went into the building. And then a little while later, they rushed out of the rushed past her down the stairwell, and they were kind of laughing and carrying on. And she said, "What's going on?" And she challenged them basically. And the young woman said, "Oh, well, we just shot the senator." And and this it gets pretty dramatic because and that kind of stunned her, and she didn't know what to think, but. What gets very dramatic is that completely independently of her, one of the first officers on the scene, LAPD officers on the scene, came into a back parking lot. He had been on patrol right out front. There were no officers in the building for a variety of reasons. But as he pulled up and parked his vehicle, he ran into an older couple who had been leaving, who had been in the parking lot, and they ran up and told him that these three young people had just passed them, laughing and talking about how they had just shot the senator. And this is completely independent of Serrano's report. And he actually documented it, wrote it up in a note, and sent it to the area where they were establishing, you know, their police control. His note disappeared. Later on, he actually has given written statements that his report about the incident was disappeared and another report was falsified. And he's actually on record as he's a very strong case that LAPD, again, was covering up reports that would have forced them to pursue conspiracy.
And what happened with that officer? I mean, if he's made public that his department was corrupt. Not that that's a surprise, and I'll share something with you about the LAPD in those years in a minute. But if he's done that, normally when that happens, as you know, the officer is disciplined or sent to Siberia or something. Anything like that happen to him?
What really happened to him is he challenged at the time, that evening, based on his report, LAPD actually issued an all-points bulletin for multiple individuals escaping the scene. Well, about 45 minutes after that, another watch officer came up and literally ordered him, told him that they had taken a person into custody, which was Sirhan, and ordered him to cancel his APB. And he said, "Well, no, that doesn't cover the girl. That's." And the watch commander essentially overrode him, got on the radio, and canceled the APB. And so he got into a pretty strong argument. But he did make his report. And the thing is that at that point in time, they established a special unit, Senator, to investigate the assassination within LAPD, which was completely compartmentalized from the rest of the force. Well, he made his report, and it wasn't until months and months later, after the whole thing was published, that he realized that the remarks attributed to him were not
falsified.
That's right. And in the end, he ended up leaving the force early because it was clear to him that, you know, his career was not going to go where he'd hoped it would go. So he didn't get fired. He left the force. He felt so strongly about it, he ended up writing not only the chief of police but the mayor. And those are on record. And interestingly enough, as you say about the LAPD, he said that it was well known that the unit was so political that if you made a report, you better protect yourself. So what they didn't know was that he kept a copy of his report.
Mm-hmm.
And he has that copy, and it's in evidence. So there's not much.
He go to another department or just take up another line of work?
And he took up another. He was pretty senior at that point in time. He was just
right.
So he basically took early retirement, if you would.
Okay, yeah. Now, let me mention here that the political climate in Los Angeles in those years, I think Parker was still chief. That would be Chief William Parker, and generally believed to be not the most straightforward, clean, and open chief of police. And do you know for sure whether I'm right about whether
Parker
was
still correct,
chief of
yes.
the
Met? Uh-huh.
Okay. Currently, the main headquarters of the Los Angeles Police Department is named after him. It's referred to as Parker Center. But he was chief of police for years and years and years. Again, generally thought of as fairly corrupt. The mayor at the time was Sam Yorty, who was nominally a Democrat, but very, very conservative. And he later became a Republican and ran for the U.S. Senate and lost. And there was no love lost between the Kennedys and Sam Yorty.
Actually, RFK, when he was giving his victory speech at the ambassador, he got towards the end of it, there's a famous remark, something on the order of, well, we need to leave now because Mayor Yorty thinks we've been here long enough.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, very interesting character. Just as a quick side note, when he was challenged for re-election by a then-city councilman who later became mayor, Tom Bradley, who was African-American, the campaign against Bradley was pretty patently racist. Sam Yorty was a real interesting guy. Anyway, do I recall correctly, Larry, that during the time immediately following the assassination, there was some kind of report, and maybe it's that same woman you were just referring to, not the one who made the report, Ms. Serrano, but the woman who made the comment about we just killed the senator. Was that the woman in the polka dot dress, or was that
Absolutely.
Somebody else?
That was the woman in the polka dot dress. And I think it's important. Serrano gave a very good description of her, height, weight, figure, dress. Mm-hmm. And if you start looking into the reports, there were at least four different witnesses that gave almost identical reports from inside the hotel at different locations. And one of the things
right.
I trace out in the essays is that you can literally trace contact between that girl and her companions over a period of some 3 hours in which they had multiple contacts with Sirhan, and in which they can clearly all be seen to be positioning themselves in the path for RFK and in the pantry way.
Now, you were saying that you just said two interesting things. One is that they actually had contact with Sirhan prior to the killing, obviously, and that was like throughout the hotel that Sirhan was in fact running around. There is now known what his whereabouts were prior to his being in the pantry.
Right. You can trace his movements pretty well. You can trace their movements pretty well. And not to go too far, but there are also witness reports that put those same people in, along with Sirhan, over a period of some 2 to 3 weeks prior to the assassination, clearly stalking Kennedy, and in one very probable attempt to shoot him at Robbie's restaurant. And earlier, you know, the thing is, it doesn't just occur all at once. There's a different definite pattern. You find them together doing pistol practice. You find them together making inquiries about where RFK is going to be. And one of the things that gets Sirhan in real problem is that actually he was at the ambassador 2 evenings earlier.
Yeah.
So this is not all coincidence.
No, and he was essentially casing it and making the plans.
Exactly.
And do I infer correctly from your statement that they had these people positioned in different places so that if Senator Kennedy took a different path, they'd get him anyway?
I would not say so much that. What they were doing is they were moving around trying to look. There were really only two ways that you could get into the ballroom and the stage area, and one would be through the main doors in the ballroom, which was being screened very heavily. There were security people there, hotel security people, and these folks are observed trying to get into that door, and they don't get in. The next time they're observed, they're standing over an area adjacent to doors that lead back into the serving hallways, or the hallways that run behind
right.
all the and And basically, those doors were unguarded. And the next time they're reported, they're inside the doors in the connecting hallways. So there's just a definite progression.
Yeah.
It appears like, you know, they're smart enough to realize, well, if I can't get in the main door, we can go through the serving area. And the interesting thing is in that the prior incident that I talked about at Robbie's restaurant, the first time there that they were stopped by security officers, they were trying to get into a serving hallway. So these folks understand how to get in back doors.
Yeah. What was I going to ask you? Oh, well, first off, let me say that we have about 8-9 minutes left. And if anyone wishes to call in and ask a question of Larry, you're welcome to do so at 347-994-3796. And I'm sort of hoping we don't get a call so you and I can just keep talking. But that said, is there any knowledge anywhere, and I assume not, of these people's names?
No, there is not. We've got pretty good descriptions. We've kind of got a profile of their behavior. They're all young. They would all be
right.
in their early 20s. You know, we've got that side of information. We don't really have any. Basically, the police did try for about 2 weeks to look and identify the girl in the polka dot dress, and they could
right.
not. And at that point, when you're reading their own internal memoranda, basically they get pretty frustrated and realize that they're never going to be able to close down this case unless they find her. And so essentially,
or give up. Yeah.
There's a memoranda that says that we got to stop this. And perhaps, probably the best thing I could do would be to describe how they stopped it, because this is really important to understanding how they shut down the investigation. And basically what they did was they kept pulling Ms. Serrano in and questioning her, putting more and more pressure on her, and really got her pretty stressed. And they started disproving her story with things that she hadn't actually said. For example, she had never said that she heard a gunshot. She said that she was outside and she heard cars, and she heard cars backfiring. Well, they did a tape recorder thing saying that she really couldn't hear a gunshot in the pantry from where she was. Well, she'd never said she heard a gunshot in the pantry.
Right.
Doesn't
disprove anything because I never said that.
Right, and then they brought in a fire marshal that said he had looked at that pantry one time during the evening and she hadn't been there. Well, okay, fine. maybe she wasn't there then. You can write reports that build that together. But that wasn't what they needed. And they really needed her to, what they needed her to was, they wanted her to say that she was making it all up. So
or
what they did is they found out that she under so much pressure, she was leaving with her aunt that she was just going to quit and go back home with her folks because she was tired of the whole thing. So there's
right.
this memo that says, the senior officer says to his polygraph expert, well, we need to deal with this, take care of it. The polygraph expert invites her and her aunt out to dinner. They go out and have a lovely steak dinner, very chatty, and then he says, well, we're going to go back over to the office and we're going to finish this. He takes her back in and puts her under polygraph, and he serves as both the interrogator and the polygraph operator.
This What's the problem with that? Let everybody
not
know.
Strictly kosher. Not that it can't be done, but normally you have an investigating officer and a polygraph operator who are separate, because the polygraph operator is trying to be objective. You know, we're not.
And an observer, right?
That's right. We're not. And so he really, the tape is available. People can actually listen to the tape, and he browbeats her. He actually tells her that she is hurting the Kennedy family. She's going to hurt RFK's memory, that the only thing that she can do is to keep from doing a terrible deed is to change her story. And after about an hour and a half of that, she agrees to change her story. And she says, well, I'm not sure of anything. And basically, he writes a memo that says, she admitted that she heard all of this story from a busboy who was talking about a polka dot dress girl when they were being held together in the hotel in a witness area.
Huh.
Now, let me describe the fatal error with that.
Yeah.
As it turns out, that cannot be true, because we have a memo. Ms. Serrano, actually, the first person she talked to was an L.A. district attorney. She talked to him outside the hotel. She told him her full story about the young people and the girl in the polka dot dress. Mm-hmm. He took her into the police. While he's taking her into the police and telling them how important a witness she is, he looks around, and the police have her in front of a live TV screen, and she's being transmitted with her story. The last thing in the world you would want in a police investigation.
Sure.
And he goes, "What are you people doing?" And the officer goes, "Well, it's too late now." And then they take her over and put her in the holding area. Well, she's already told her story. So
she couldn't have gotten it from the busboy while they were being held.
But the polygraph operator is saying that under polygraph, she is telling the truth with the busboy story, which can't be true, which, guess what, means he's not telling the truth. So
right.
His polygraph...
Go ahead, Larry.
They would have thrown everything relating to his polygraph work out of the trial if this had come up, because he has certified as true a statement that is definitively untrue.
Impossible to be true.
Yep.
We have only about 4 minutes left, and we're obviously not going to cover this. Can you come back perhaps the beginning of May? We can finish this up. We can talk a little more now, but are you available?
Sure, you bet.
Okay, all right. So we'll get together again on the same day as the British election, May 6th. But in brief, the basic question is, Sirhan was involved with the killing, and he was part of this, and he in fact took shots at the senator, right?
Right.
And he it's not like a situation where perhaps occurred with the JFK assassination, where in fact Lee Harvey Oswald may have been telling the truth when he said, "I'm just a patsy."
Right. This can't have been done strictly as a setup. I mean, there's got to be something going on from a conspiracy standpoint.
Right. And in terms of real briefly, in terms of a trial, do I recall correctly that Sirhan actually pleaded guilty, or did they actually have a trial?
They had a trial.
They did. Okay.
Basically, his defense was essentially a temporary insanity type defense. It was very convoluted. The fact that he somehow had been hypnotized by a combination of lights and mirrors and, basically just did not have control of himself. So that was his, yes, there was an extended trial.
Yeah, well, I know he was convicted, obviously. He was
convicted.
He was convicted, and he was sentenced to death
And then California basically did away with the death penalty, and Sirhan is still in prison and still in solitary.
Oh, really? I didn't know he was in solitary. Actually, I think that particular death penalty elimination, that I think was when the Supreme Court did it.
Oh, okay.
Of the United States. I'm not positive of that, but I'm fairly sure that it was the United States Supreme Court that banned the death penalty at that time. Of course, we now have death penalties again, but they did that, and of course they couldn't go back once the death penalty was reinstated, because that would be an ex post facto law. And I'm talking fast because we have a minute left. So let me first invite everyone again to go to Larry-Hancock, HANCOCK.com, and take a look at his book on the JFK assassination, Someone Would Have Talked, or go to Amazon.com for that, and you'll be able to find it. And Larry will be joining us again. We'll confirm the date by email, but it looks like May 6th would be best, and we'll continue. We'll wind up about the Robert Kennedy assassination and talk about the great question, which is, who done it?
Indeed. Thanks again.
Or who was behind it. Hey, Larry, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to that, and I'll drop you a note. And to everybody else, thank you for joining us, and I'll go ahead and let you go, Larry. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
You take care. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. And with great thanks to Larry Hancock, this is Jeff Bushman. You've been listening to Speaking of Everything, of course, on Blog Talk Radio. Obviously, he's a fascinating guest, and we'll have him back. In the meantime, next week, we will have joining us a mystery writer who has a published mystery novel, and his name is Joe Traum. I hope you'll join us then. In the meantime, I hope you'll have a great week and keep spending money at the malls, because the because retail spending has been up 9%, I believe, in the last month. And one way to help end the recession is by putting more money in the economy, as the stimulus program taught us. So with that, have a great week. Thanks to my producers who have now left the room, and have a great week. Bye-bye.